This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Tom Hayden joins us to talk about his new book, Listen Yankee, Why Cuba Matters.
With Cuba's victory over the United States in getting America to recognize them diplomatically, the ballgame may be changed.
We'll talk about the outpouring in the streets of Baltimore in response to the police murder of Freddie Gray.
With a community largely unemployed, homeless, and impoverished by neoliberalism, is what happened in Baltimore any surprise?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, last week I woke up and opened the New York Times and I saw a half-page ad on the seventh page about Mumia. Would you please read that to us?
Yes, Michael. The Committee to Save Mumia Abu-Jamal has placed an ad. It reads, boldface, Mumia Abu-Jamal is dying in prison from medical neglect. Then it goes on to say, if medical specialists do not treat Mumia Abu-Jamal immediately, the world-renowned author and radio journalist may die in the next few weeks. Alice Walker has lauded him as, quote, a rare and courageous voice speaking from a place we fear to know. Mumia Abu-Jamal must be heard. Losing that voice would be like losing a color from the rainbow. In the past 3 months, Mumia Abu-Jamal has lost 65 pounds, fallen into diabetic shock, and developed gallstones. Black, crusting lesions cover his entire body. His extremities have swollen, and blood taints his urine. Prison neglect and mistreatment have caused his undiagnosed illness to worsen, and Mumia now languishes in his prison cell, barely able to eat, stand, or keep awake. He is just 61. Call Secretary John Wetzel at the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections at 717-728-2573. Urge him to allow Mumia Abu-Jamal to receive medical attention from volunteer specialist doctors who stand by ready to assist.
Thanks, Heidi. Would you read that phone number one more time, please?
It's 717-728-2573. Keep those calls coming. As relations between the United States and Cuba are radically changing, Tom Hayden's new book, Listen Yankee, Why Cuba Matters, is especially timely. It offers thoughtful analysis and insights into the efforts of intellectuals, social justice activists, and politicians that help bring about normalization efforts. Listen Yankee is both a historical account and a personal memoir of Hayden as a revolutionary student leader and SDS founder, whose own early work to spur radical change mirrored the transformation going on in Cuba. His book is based, in part, on conversations with Ricardo Alarcón, one of the leaders of the revolution, a UN representative, and a former guest of Law and Disorder.
On December 17, 2015, Presidents Obama and Castro announced that their two countries would begin the process of establishing diplomatic relations and work towards a normalization of relations between them. Cuba now needs all the solidarity it can get. Author Tom Hayden has just written the book Listen Yankee, Why Cuba Matters, based in part on conversations with Ricardo Alarcón. We thank Tom for his excellent work and welcome him to Law and Disorder. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning.
Tom, you've said that your conversations with Ricardo Alarcón have formed the backbone of this book. Can you explain your relationship with him and his relevance?
Well, when I wrote the book, Seven Stories Press, my publisher said it had to be by me because nobody knew Ricardo Alarcón. That may be true in this country, in this market. But here's an example of how devastating the embargo has been and how isolated North Americans have become, because here's a man who's probably one of the most knowledgeable diplomats in the entire world, former president of the National Assembly, former foreign minister, former UN representative of Cuba, and my publisher thinks nobody knows him. So, assuming that, the book unfolded in several stages. One, Ricardo Alarcón invited me in 2006 to visit Cuba, and I went. I had known him tangentially from years before. He was busy at the time. He was running the National Assembly, of course, but every day for several hours he interviewed me about the Port Huron Statement and about the American New Left and the history of the New Left in relation to the Cuban Revolution for the purpose, he said, of the Cuban archives. They're meticulous about the history of different movements in the world. That's some time ago. That was at a time when Fidel had his serious health episode. It was also around the time that Brazil was becoming a progressive country by elections. It was a time of change beneath the surface in Latin America. I was glad to fulfill the mission. I'm sorry I don't have the transcripts. Present at the interviews I did was Ricardo's assistant, who turned out to apparently be an informant of some kind and is now in a Cuban prison. So he's heard, and the agencies have heard everything I had to say about the history of the New Left. Fast forward, I had this intuition in 2013 that we were going to normalize relations or establish diplomatic relations. I don't know why. My friends on the left said it was impossible. My adversaries on the right said it was impossible. But it was my intuition that both Obama and Raul Castro wanted this as part of a legacy or moving on to a new stage, and they had the backing of sufficient elements within both countries to do so. But it had to be top secret. Here we're talking about people who are usually in the know, not knowing anything. And it unfolded that way until 2015, and now it seems to be proceeding along pretty rationally, pretty stably, with obviously many contradictions, many questions, bumps along the way. But I think that we are in a well into the transition with all that it suggests.
Tom, you recounted a conversation with Ricardo that I thought was striking. You asked him, do you agree with Marta Honecker and others who say that electoral democracy finally became a real option for Latin American left after Venezuela and other Latin American parties were elected to power? And Ricardo answered you in what I thought was really a striking and thoughtful answer. And I think it would be helpful if you would just read Ricardo's answer to our audience.
I'm glad to read Ricardo's words. I agree that electoral democracy has become an option for the left, as has been shown by recent developments. This is the result of long years of struggle, including the time of the guerrillas, the successful resistance of the Cuban people, and the relative decline of U.S. imperialist hegemony in Latin America and the world. But there have been some setbacks also, and attempts to restore dictatorships cannot be excluded. I want to add that I do not accept the notion, however, that democracy equals an electoral party system with only one, two, or however many parties alone. Empowering people must go far beyond elections. Capitalism and democracy are contradictory and antagonistic terms. Socialism, if it is genuine, should imply participatory democracy. That's what he said.
And the Cubans are still trying to accomplish this against strong headwinds, continuing strong headwinds. And I wondered whether you could give us, in a nutshell, Tom, a short history of American relations with Cuba once the Cuban Revolution in 1959 had come to power.
Well, I think your listeners are pretty familiar with that. But let me say one thing, going back to Ricardo Alarcón's comment. One of the basic foundations of American policy is the export of our idea of democracy to other countries. It's essential to our image of ourselves. And what I think this comes down to in Cuba is the secret export of a kind of democracy through CIA transmissions, secret agents, people smuggling communication devices there. It's an odd kind of democracy by secrecy, by stealth. And it's no wonder that people like Ricardo Alarcón or the Cubans are baffled at the idea that they should adopt American democracy when they see what it's meant for their country. Go all the way going back to the invasion, the Bay of Pigs, the attempted assassinations. My advice to Obama or the State Department would be, don't try to package our form of democracy without first understanding how repugnant it is to people who are on the receiving end. You do have to come up with some other package. And I think, at the very least, it's on the table. The Congress will decide in the budget whether to fund these secret democracy programs or not. That's an open question. I'm sure the Cubans will say, we don't mind your funding this or that, but it ought to be above board and on the table. And the Americans will cling to secret transmissions and tapes being smuggled in and the rest of it. So if I were the Cubans now and I was called to task for having a one-party state and empty elections, I would call an election immediately, allow as many candidates as possible to compete, and definitely the Communist Party would win at this point because the vast majority of Cubans like this agreement, and it's a great accomplishment, and they feel vindicated. In the future, there'll be differences in Cuba that will cause factions or conflicts, undoubtedly. But right now, you're playing an empty card if you advise the Cubans to have an election.
Talk a bit about the embargo. How likely is it that we'll see the boycott lifted in the next few years, the embargo?
Well, this is a partial agreement, but I think it deals a death blow to the U.S. embargo, because if you can go to Cuba with a credit card, which seems to be guaranteed in the agreement, you can spend money in Cuba on art, on whatever you wish, and so you hollow out the embargo from within. What remains is a very odd thing that I leave it to the Republicans to debate in Congress. Under the Helms-Burton law, what's left after this agreement is a prohibition on tourism by Americans. So there'll be a big debate about whether you can go as tourists, when in fact everybody's going through expanded travel categories anyway. A million Canadians go a year on top of that, a million Europeans, half a million Americans of Cuban descent. So it's crumbling, and the lifting of the terrorism designation will increase the access that Cuba has to investment by private banks and so on. I thought, under the rules of capitalism, people would like banks to have investment opportunities and finance projects in Cuba. But we have to remember that's been prohibited for many decades because of the attempt to strangle and bring down the Cuban government through the denial of these loans, which go to every other country in the world.
On the election question, Tom, of course, there are elections in Cuba, but there are no parties in Cuba other than the Communist Party. And when the Cubans are asked about that, they defend themselves and say, look, if we opened it up and allowed for a competitive party, the CIA would set up a party and we'd be in a lot of trouble. So we have elections and people are elected at all levels of government, but on a non-party basis. How do you view that changing, if you think it would?
I don't know. It's obviously that's up to the Cubans. It's a question of their sovereignty. There's nothing to brag about in multi-party elections. For example, we have multi-party elections in Canada. My wife is Canadian. And the liberals and the left split, and the conservatives win. So Canada is run by a George Bush follower with 38% of the popular vote. So the number of parties is not the question. I think it's up in the air. What is the solution? But a one-party state run by the leaders of the Cuban Revolution from the late 50s is not a solution either. So they're going to have to deal with this. I think what Ricardo Alarcón is talking about is, for example, cooperatives in which workers and consumers have a share in the organization of the business. The question of certain things that are state-controlled, state-funded, have to be protected, education, health care, and so on. But anybody who's been to Cuba knows that people have complaints about the state as well. So how you democratize the state or make bureaucracy more flexible is a big question. And he actually is a student of Max Weber and some of these other theorists on this. I hope that the Cubans come up with a solution to this riddle. But as I say, it's not for us to impose. And I think what will be most dramatic is if the threat from the United States actually recedes, and it seems to be receding, that will allow Cubans to open up, you know, without fear that entertaining any dissent is helping the United States. That's just my speculation, but it's for them to deal with.
Yeah, well, you asked Ricardo about that, Tom, and Ricardo answered, yes, it's obviously a very difficult task to develop a democratic system under conditions of economic and political warfare.
Exactly.
Tom, you dedicate your book, Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters, to Gene Stein, and to the memory of Sal Landau and Len Wineglass. And we wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about why you dedicated it to these three people.
Well, let me say in general, I wanted to acknowledge and report on the history of North American citizens, U.S. citizens, in this whole process going back to the 50s, and how important solidarity groups or the Venceremos Brigade or those who have defied the travel ban and paid a price to go to Cuba have been, not only here in keeping a lobbying effort alive, which was critical, but also there. The Cubans may not quite say so in the manner I do, but who am I? I'm just a North American guy. But I think the interaction has been beneficial both ways. For example, Raul Castro's daughter, Mariela, is a leader of the LGBT movement and a sometimes dissenting member of the National Assembly. And she's known around the world, but also in Cuba. And it's been a tough fight for LGBT rights since Allen Ginsberg was thrown out of Cuba in 1965. And the Cuban government had a backward position, not that we had a forward position, but they had a very backward position for a very long time. So somehow, without lifting the one-party rule, iron-fisted Castro rule, somehow LGBT rights have become much more appreciated and recognized in Cuba. And how did that happen if it's not a democracy? I think it partly happened because the Cubans pay attention to world events and other movements, and they listen to their American friends who come down or tourists who come down, and gradually there's an osmosis, an absorption of ideas that might start here or start in Europe and wind up there. And that's how it should be in an interconnected world. That's what globalization is supposed to be about.
But talk to us a little more, will you please, about Gene Stein's contribution
yes,
to your
I was
thinking
going to go on.
And Len and Saul?
Well, Gene was a visitor to Cuba a few years ago. She's a New Yorker, of course, and very sophisticated and learned woman who was a patron of authors and artists. And she pushed me to do the book with Ricardo. She knew him, and she wanted his voice heard in the United States, and she thought that I might be able to figure out a way to make this happen. And Saul, I've known, you know, since 1960, I guess. Saul, who recently died, was a early visitor to Cuba, was the interpreter for the author C. Wright Mills from Columbia University, who went down to Cuba and wrote the book Listen, Yankee, on which my book is named after. And I don't know how many trips to Cuba Saul made over his lifetime, but it had to be in the range of 100. I don't know. But he did everything from interpreting the Cuban Revolution in film to passing messages to Henry Kissinger. He lobbied for the Cuban Five when most people thought it was an entirely lost cause. He was a hero of lost causes, Saul was. And I saw him last. He was dying at his home in Alameda out in California. And he asked me, you know, what I had learned, because I had used interviews with him in preparing this book. And he wanted to know how it was going and what I forecast. And I said, I still think that they're going to normalize relations. And he said, he could barely talk, but he said, that's good. And then he paused to summon his energy again, and he said, it's not a paradise. Too many people think it's a paradise. They just want to be seen as a regular country. And I thought that that was a sort of a fitting statement at this stage, because revolutions are like people like Saul. They do hit middle age. They do grow old. Power grows old. Power dies away and has to be reborn in new generations. And I think he wanted Cuba to be seen as a regular country. The issue of Len I don't know where to begin. I met Len Weinglass in Newark 50 years ago, at least, and he was our attorney with Bill Kunstler and others in the Chicago conspiracy trial in 1969-1970. At some point, he became another champion of lost causes. This seems to be a pattern among American radicals, and it's an honorable pattern. I'm more inclined to the pragmatic, but I appreciate the champions of lost causes. So he took up the case of the Cuban Five, and he was tireless. He went out to that high-security prison in California on many occasions. He went down to Cuba. He understood the case. He prepared the appellate arguments. He didn't make it either, but he got sick in Cuba, or the cancer symptoms came upon him when he was at a Cuba Five meeting in Havana. And he said, by the way, it was a terrible meeting, and he had to fly back. He was diagnosed here, and he died not long after. These three are examples of how many thousands of people from our country have taken up the cause of better relations with Cuba, solidarity with Cuba, and have been Yankees who listened to the Cubans instead of Yankees that lectured the Cubans.
You mentioned that Len left you some notes related to the Cuban Five and the shoot down. Can you briefly talk about the significance of that case?
Well, the case is covered in the book, by the way. I did have access to interview with many national security officials from the U.S. government and State Department going back to the Kennedy-Johnson years and then forward to Carter, Clinton, and Obama. And it's a history of divisions within the American government between the Cold War hawkish elements and those who more realistically believe that a failed path should not be repeated and there should be some relaxation. And in the case of the Cuban Five, it revolved around a very strange incident in which Cuban exiles had a sanctuary in Florida for years from which they could attack Cuba, physically attack, or launch propaganda offensives by flying planes, Cessnas, that would buzz the island and deposit thousands of leaflets urging people to somehow rise up after seeing the plane overhead.
Imagine if the Cubans did that to Washington, D.C.
No, God knows what. God knows if anybody, what would have happened if anybody had taken them up. I mean, about four people would have joined that kind of protest. But it went on and on and on. And according to my research, and this is where Lenny was trying to do the analysis, there's an outstanding question about whether when the planes were shot down, two Cessnas killing four people, whether they had entered Cuban airspace. And that is against international law and would justify a shoot down. But the documents are still under seal. We have to demand that those documents be released to clarify what the situation was. In any event, it was a provocation that should not have happened. And my research says that, according to Mort Halpern, who was in charge at the White House, orders were supposed to be carried out that the planes not fly, that they be grounded. However, the planes took off, which is another illustration of the two faces of the U.S. government, or the hydra-headed nature of the U.S. government. Who knows? That was, he says, a deliberate attempt by the Cuban right-wing exiles to have the planes shot down in order to end any possibility of normalization between the U.S. and Cuba. That's what Len was working on, and that is what happened. Clinton might or might not have moved forward, but when that happened, he signed Helms-Burton and everything ground to a halt. So the terrorist group in Florida, who's never described that way, did succeed in delaying normalization by 10 or 20 years as a result of that incident, or so I surmise.
Of course, the Helms-Burton law, which requires Congress.
Clinton gave that.
Pull back. Clinton gave
amendment
it to
Congress,
and that,
yes.
That's the embargo. And,
that's
and
right.
Until we can get rid of that embargo,
that's right.
The Cubans have a very difficult time because of the stunting of their economy. I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Tom Hayden, who has just come out with Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters, a very fine book, which we could recommend to all of our listeners. Tom, you talk in the book about how the situation in Latin America has changed so dramatically in recent times. When the Cuban Revolution happened, the American response was to isolate Cuba and to overthrow any government that was friendly to Cuba. And Cuba indeed was isolated for many years. But now that's no longer the case. And I wanted you to talk a bit about how the United States became the country that was isolated, which, in my opinion, led to the recognition of Cuba diplomatically.
I think you're right. That's a fundamental shift in Latin America. And Ricardo Alarcón says it came about in part because of the insurrections by the guerrillas, the shift in Latin America, the huge demonstrations in Brazil, the falling of dictatorships, so that at the end of the story, Cuba was integrated into the hemisphere and the U.S. was isolated from the hemisphere. He also pointed out that the possibility of going back is still in existence. The case of Venezuela being destabilized being an example. The crisis in Brazil is chronic and very, very deep. Honduras, yes. So Haiti, it's not over. But the shift in general was toward the direction of something that apparently Ricardo Alarcón had been thinking about for many, many decades.
We're speaking with Tom Hayden, author of Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters. We'll be right back after this break. you're just joining us, we're speaking with Tom Hayden, the author of the just-published book Listen Yankee, Why Cuba Matters, based in part on conversations with Ricardo Alarcón.
The idea of a what the Venezuelans call 21st century socialism meant two things. One, a democratic socialism was possible by electoral means, and two, it had to be unique to each country's culture and heritage and traditions. It could not be a copycat, a blueprint from Moscow or Peking or some world socialist headquarters. And there was a Jose Martegui, who is a theorist in the 1920s from Peru, who I was introduced to, not personally, but his works by Ricardo Alarcón, was the originator of this concept. At the time of the Russian Revolution, there was a lot of ideological discussion among Latin American radicals and revolutionaries about what it meant. And some formed communist parties in the tradition of the direction of the Russians, the Soviets. Others formed Trotskyist groups. A few decades later, there were others that formed Maoist groups. And what the Peruvian theorist has said is, and is repeated by Ricardo, is that he was interested in heroic creation. Heroic creation. That meant the act of revolution had to be an act of heroism, of taking a risk, going off the cliff, perhaps, in many cases. But it also had to be an act of creation, which meant not a hand-me-down repetition of what somebody did in some other country. And the struggle to have heroic creation, to have authentic revolutionary movements in all these countries, working together but separate from each other and unique, has been extremely hard in a world that is dominated by large blocks of capitalist countries, of religious countries, of communist countries, different Marxist traditions. How could you get something that was original and democratic if you're a country of 11 million? Very, very difficult, but I think that's the path that he's always been on. And the changes in Latin America help complement that path, because you have Latin American unity, but each country, you know, has their own flag, yeah, but different tendencies. The Bolivians are very different than, say, the left in Argentina, or the left in Chile, which is more on the American side of the equation. Still, there's an authentic left in Chile. And if you look behind the headlines, you'll see that the genuine successful efforts at social movements in Latin America always come from an original base. Something happened there to some coal miners, or somebody was massacred in Nicaragua or El Salvador. And out of that arose movements that have their own characteristics. And that's what he's getting at.
Well, that was precisely what happened in Cuba, of course.
Exactly. And they were arguing for the originality of their revolution. Mills understood that and wrote about it. But in time, they felt that they were obligated to take sides with the two phenomena, the Soviet bloc and the non-aligned bloc. Now, how could Cuba be aligned with the Soviet Union and but also be the head of the non-aligned bloc? We should have discussions about how that happened and what that meant, but we're blockaded from knowing. We don't have any access to how that happened. Anyway, you can tell from the book, Ricardo doesn't seem to want to leave an impression that he was at any time, you know, very sympathetic to the Soviets. While he understood the Soviets saved them economically for a period of time, so it takes nerve to say this. And he was a member of the Communist Party Politburo for a time. But I still think we're looking at somebody who's more like an early member of the Students for a Democratic Society who just happened to be living in Cuba. And that he is coming out of this still struggling for a solution to the global crisis. He has a very interesting perspective on the immigrant rights movement. You know, with the new situation, Cubans will no longer be pampered and privileged in becoming American citizens. They'll have to get in line with other immigrants. They'll have to get involved in the immigrant rights crisis in the United States. Having Cuba involved opens up an opportunity to build a Jose Marti construct of solidarity across the Americas, with millions here living here trapped without being enfranchised, at risk of being deported, fighting for stability, and with others coming as a result of our interventions there. Most of them are economic refugees from poverty. And I think that what he's saying is that Marti's concept of our America meant some kind of synthesis of what is now considered, you know, North, Central, and South America. And Cuba is a pivot in that discussion, I think.
Tom, I know that our colleagues and friends in Cuba would love to read your book. Are there plans to translate it?
You should go online and demand that Seven Stories hurry up with the Spanish translation. I think it's coming, but I don't know the bureaucracy of publishing very well. But I surely wish that more than a few copies in English were down there, and I hope before the year is out that can happen. It also, sections of it also can be translated and put online.
Yeah, you know, we really need about 6 hours to do justice to this book, Tom.
I don't think so.
I read it cover to cover. I was absolutely fascinated by it. I particularly liked your engagements with Ricardo Alarcón. It's a very fine contribution to the work of understanding Cuba and giving solidarity to Cuba. And I think also a contribution to what we can do here in the United States by learning from what the Cubans have been trying to do. We've been speaking with Tom Hayden, who recently had published Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters, based in part on conversations with Ricardo Alarcón. It's published by Seven Stories Press. It's a very good book. We recommend that people read it.
Take it to Cuba and read it on the beach.
Great idea.
You can, if you don't understand what I've said or you disagree, you can go to Cuba and find out for yourself. I think there's a surge of interest in Cuba travel, no?
Oh, everybody
yes.
and their uncle wants to go to Cuba. You can't get on a plane to get there, and you can't get a hotel room if you get there, and for good reason. It's a really amazing place. People should try to go.
We love it.
And hopefully it'll get loosened up so that they'll be able to. I understand that there are negotiations now with airlines.
You can imagine.
Right.
You can only imagine. Delta wants greater runways. my interest, I don't mean to go on, is baseball. Because we got Cuban guys on the Dodgers.
Right.
And my general belief is that the Cubans are now the best players in Major League Baseball in every category. And there's hundreds more. But look, they have to give up their Cuban citizenship, become illegal aliens, as we say, put their lives at risk of drug smugglers, go to another country, change their appearance to get to work out in the major leagues. On a normal relationship, a Yankee scout should be able to go sit in the bleachers in Havana Stadium and interview people and their families and make them offers. The Cuban government should be able to impose a tax and gain revenue on the salaries that these players make. They should come here. They should be able to play winter ball in Cuba as Cuban, as Cuban nationals, as Dominicans do. There should be television that captures baseball both ways. And I am also going to end with this. I want that Tampa team moved to Havana. If they can go to Montreal or to Toronto, why can't we have Major League Baseball in Cuba? I think it's high on my priority list, except for maybe you could remake the Guantanamo facility into a Major League Baseball stadium jointly owned by the United States and Cuba.
We'll lobby
for that.
Why not?
Tom Hayden, Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters. Terrific book. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder, Tom.
Thanks.
Thank you. Events continue to unfold in Baltimore in response to the police murder of Freddie Gray. Today, we examine how stereotypes are perpetuated of the rebels in the streets. The mainstream press, pundits, and elected officials, black and white, call them thugs. We're joined by Ajamu Baraka, human rights activist, organizer, and editor and contributing columnist for the Black Agenda Report.
Ajamu Baraka, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Ajamu, let's get right to the heart of the question here. Why did Baltimore happen?
Well, you know, Michael, it could have happened any place. That the situation that we saw unfold in Baltimore was a situation that we have seen surface around the country with the increase of cameras and the increased attention on the brutality of these police forces in poor black communities across the country. Now, what happened with Baltimore was that it was maybe a little bit more egregious in the fact that he was an individual who was arrested, who was visibly injured, who then ends up in the hospital in a coma and then dies with a broken spine. And then you have, of course, the reaction from the community. But this could have been almost any place. I mean, it's another example of the out-of-control nature of these police forces who are tasked with the responsibility of having to police and control and contain a population that is essentially surplus population that no one really cares about, including the black middle class.
Speak, if you will, briefly on how the mainstream media and elected officials and others are characterizing many of the young people who took to the streets as thugs.
Well, you know, we all know that the thugs is a euphemism for nigger. And it is unfortunate that Barack Obama and the black middle class leadership provided the cover, the green light, if you will, for some of the most backward and vicious kind of distortions and negative characterizations of resistors in Baltimore, the one can't imagine or one that something that we haven't seen, even with Ferguson. So it's really unfortunate that because of that cover and green light given by black folks, that we saw the ugly face of racism, respectable racism that is, rise to the surface again, because no one wanted to use the real terms, but the racialist framework was always there, you know, beneath the surface, that these are individuals who are prone to violence, are just naturally irrational, and therefore there's no basis for any kind of sympathy or even understanding of the issues in Baltimore. It's just that these are just thugs, non-humans, if you will, who only understand the language of force.
I'm going to read you a quote and ask you for your comment. This is a quote from one of the leaders of the Russian Revolution. He observes, "A slave owner who through cunning and violence shackles a slave in chains, and a slave who through cunning and violence breaks the chains, let not the contemptible eunuchs tell us that they are equals before a court of morality." That's a quote from Leon Trotsky. That's a quote from almost 100 years ago. I think it so succinctly applies to what's going on in Baltimore today, this hypocritical condemnation of violence.
You're absolutely right. I mean, how can the enslaved, how can the oppressed have the same ethical framework, operate within the same ethical framework as the slave owner, as the oppressor? But that is the weapon that's used to delegitimize resistance. Not only are we oppressed, but when we resist, we have to resist in a certain kind of way, or we're going to be condemned. It's backward, of course, but it's something that I think that the young people, the young activists, are not really falling for necessarily. And that's why we see the kind of split that we have in the black community and really in the broader community around how people are going to resist the reality of concentrated state violence being directed in these black communities.
Jamu, if you were running one of these major metropolitan cities, how would you deal with an incident, a tragic incident, a fatal police killing of a civilian? What would you do?
Well, first thing I would assume would be that I would have a police force that would have a different kind of relationship to the community. That if Jamu Baraka was running a city, there would have already been a revolutionary process, so that we would have a situation where the community itself was responsible for its own quote-unquote policing. But assuming that, just in for the sake of the question, I think the first thing that has to happen in these kinds of situations is that there is a real commitment on the part of the local authorities to address the issue and to try to communicate to the community that if there, in fact, is the basis for prosecution, legal prosecution, that in fact, will happen. And that they're going to ensure that if there are issues with the between the community and the police force, that those issues are addressed. But see, the problem we have, even in this kind of hypothetical situation, that, again, we're not talking about a transformed social relationship between police and the state. Then we look at it and we deal with the reality of what we have today and the mission of the police forces in these urban environments across the country. The kind of violence that we see, the brutality that we have witnessed, is not going to go away. You're not going to be able to resolve these issues through dialogue or more community policing or any of these kinds of tactics, because there are fundamental contradictions in the relationships here. The mission of the police force is to basically control and contain this redundant population. And repression is the main weapon that's used. So we're not going to see a decrease in these kinds of incidents. As a matter of fact, I fully expect to see these incidents continue and to even become even more intense and kind of violent character of them.
You know, a concern that many of us have is when evidence surfaces that police officers are members of or have ties to white supremacist groups.
Yes.
And that, I think, is more frequent than we realize.
You're absolutely right, and that's something that people are not talking about. As a matter of fact, there was a study that the federal government produced and then quickly erased, quickly got rid of, that indicated that there was effective and strong recruitment taking place among the military by these white supremacist groups and among the police forces.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, there's another issue, too, that we have to take a look at. I'm actually in the process of writing a piece on this, and that is the connection between members of these police forces and these individuals' membership in National Guard and Army Reserve units, units that ended up in Iraq, Afghanistan, and these individuals served sometimes in multiple tours and then came back to their civilian environment, back to their police jobs, and then brought those skills and those attitudes back with them and back to the urban areas, policing the internal enemy, if you will, in our communities. That's a very dangerous phenomenon that we need to look at even more closer.
And put it in the context of 60% of black people between the ages of 16 and 64 are out of work in Baltimore. 30% of the buildings in Baltimore are vacant. Poverty rates at 25%. That's the kind of community that these people are repressing.
Exactly. And then when you look at the figures in an even more concentrated form, when you look at the epicenter, if you will, of the resistance, which is northwest of Baltimore, then the figures are even more dramatic. You have something like 40% of the population living below the official poverty level. You have something like officially 13% unemployment, but the real employment is probably around 32%. You have a medium income around $21,000. So, yeah, that's the social environment, and those are the material conditions that people in that community are facing, and that's why they are upset and angry, because they know and no one cares about them. They know that those black middle-class officials who are partying and having a good time along the waterfront there in Baltimore, they don't care about that population. And that, and those folks, they know that.
Do you think the federal government, and in specific the new attorney general, has a role to play in addressing what we're seeing across the nation?
I think they have a role in the sense that, that the federal government should have always been the target of the anti-police violence movement, forcing the Obama administration and Eric Holder to be more forthcoming or more aggressive in attempting to try to mitigate the sense of impunity that many of these police forces, I think, felt across the country. So that didn't happen, but I think it should happen. Now, in terms of there being a real positive response, that remains to be seen, and even less likely now under this new Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, because her background and orientation is such that she's not even willing to provide this sort of symbolic bones, if you will, thrown to the black community. In fact, her first public statements that I'm sure you all are aware of were statements that were basically pro-police. Her concern about the detrimental images of police around the country. She was going to go on a national tour visiting various police departments. So we don't expect much from her, but I still believe that the federal government, because of its responsibilities, should still be a main target of the political activity.
We just have 60 seconds remaining, Ajamu. It's been a pleasure to have you on. A final word on police unions before we go.
Well, the police unions are going to do what they've been doing for decades, that is to protect their members, to hold up white supremacy, and to undermine any attempt to address the issue of impunity. So we understand who they are, their interests, and we might need to begin to give those unions more focus in terms of political oppositional work.
Ajamu Baraka, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
It is my pleasure.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.